Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a story and issue in the news that looms large following today's ruling by the Supreme Court to strike down the key provision in the Voting Rights Act that protects young, elderly and minority voters in 15 states from an array of new and improved Jim Crow laws and voting suppression devices that make it harder for those likely to vote for Democratic candidates. Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, who was in the Supreme Court today, joins us to discuss this radical ruling. Then we'll examine the implications of this ruling on voting rights and election protection with Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, where she founded and directs the center's Voting Rights and Election Project. We will discuss what remedies are likely to come from a gridlocked and dysfunctional Congress and whether it will be open season from now on in those states with a recent history of trying to enact voter suppression laws that were stopped by the Voting Rights Act, given that they are now free to enact a whole range of voting restrictions claiming to prevent the negligible, if not non-existent, problem of voter fraud. Then finally, we will speak with Azeez Haque, who was a clerk at the Supreme Court for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who issued a strong and almost indignant dissent, which she read aloud, pointing out the lack of logic and legal underpinning of the conservative majority's opinion that praised the effectiveness of the Voting Rights Act before gutting the very mechanism that makes it work, while declaring it unconstitutional without bothering to cite what part of the Constitution it violated. And joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, who's the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Court of Appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you.
And you were in the Supreme Court today when the decision came down to void Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which effectively nullifies the important Section 5, which requires mostly southern states with a history of discrimination to have preclearance from the federal government if they want to change their voting laws. And as recently as in this last election cycle, both Texas and South Carolina tried to make it more difficult for minorities to vote, and the federal government intervened under Section 5. So what was the sense? Because it was a very, I thought, very passionate and well-argued dissent from Justice Ginsburg. But since you were there, what was the body language, if you will, of the same five justices who ruled on Citizens United?
Well, I think that Justice Alito might have gotten a talking to from Chief Justice Roberts after he rolled his eyes and shook his head while Justice Ginsburg was reading her dissent in some employment discrimination cases yesterday, because the body language was certainly not as notable as yesterday. But you're right, Justice Ginsburg gave a very well-reasoned dissent that focused on how the text and history of the Constitution support what Congress did when it reenacted the Voting Rights Act and this all-important preclearance provision. And not only that, but she also cited all of the evidence that shows that this preclearance provision continues to be the most important shield of protection that Americans have to ensure that their right to vote is not burdened by racial discrimination.
Well, the odd thing about this ruling is that Justice Roberts, in his opinion, wrote that there is no doubt that these improvements are in large part because of the Voting Rights Act. The Act has proved immensely successful at redressing racial discrimination and integrating the voting process. So on the one hand, he says this is the reason this has worked, but then he turns around and him and his four conservative colleagues turn around and take away the reasons why it's worked. I mean, it's a peculiar ruling.
It's so successful. Now let's gut it. it's very, I think, disheartening. Congressman Lewis, who nearly died trying to get the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965, said that the majority's opinion put a dagger through the heart of the Voting Rights Act, and I totally agree. You know, it's very odd that the majority of the court relied so much on progress that our country has made in preventing racial discrimination in voting, when that progress is in large part due to the success of the preclearance provision. And to take that away really just doesn't make any sense from a policy standpoint, and certainly is not supported by the Constitution, which puts the decision on how best to protect the right to vote squarely in the hands of Congress. It says in the 15th Amendment, Congress shall enforce the protections that are in that amendment and in the other amendments that protect the right to vote. The Supreme Court today basically second-guessed Congress and disregarded the more than 10,000 pages of record that Congress amassed when it decided to reauthorize the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act in 2006.
So when the Chief Justice Roberts says that the 40-year-old formula that the Voting Rights Act is operated under is based on obsolete statistics and that the coverage formula violates the Constitution, that's the opposite of what you're saying, that this ruling violates the Constitution. Did Roberts elaborate on what part of the Constitution the Section 4 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act violated?
No, and, you know, I think that it is incredibly important for everyone to understand that. Chief Justice Roberts never identifies the provision of the Constitution that the coverage formula, that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, violates. Even though he is striking down a part of a congressional enactment, he never identifies what part of the Constitution it violates. You know, he says that that the Voting Rights Act is inconsistent with the letter and spirit of the Constitution, but his opinion is all spirit. You know, conservatives like to mock decisions that rely on emanations and penumbras, but you know, that's what's going on in his opinion today. And I think it's very important to note that, you know, he says this is outdated, but as Justice Ginsburg listed in her dissent, we have numerous examples of changes to voting laws that were blocked in the years leading up to the 2006 reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act because of preclearance. These aren't, 40-year-old problems. These are problems that were going on in the 90s, in 2000s, and as we saw in the last election, continue to be a problem with states trying to suppress the African-American vote and being, we've had FBI investigations catch state legislators on record admitting that they're trying to specifically suppress the African-American votes.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wider, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Court of Appeals and was in the Supreme Court today when this, what seems to be a radical ruling, came down in voiding Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, and in doing so, making Section 5, the important section, pretty much moot. I mean, since it appears to be, again, you just said that in effect that this is a form of judicial activism, the very thing that conservative judges accuse liberal judges of doing, of violating the original intent. I mean, isn't the 15th Amendment, isn't that a part of original intent?
Absolutely. And if you look at the original meaning of the 15th Amendment, and in particular, the enforcement clause of the 15th Amendment, which specifically gives Congress the authority to enforce the right to vote free from discrimination, that is, free from racial discrimination, that is promised in the 15th Amendment. The drafters of that amendment specifically wanted Congress to be able to be the one to decide how best to protect the right to vote, because, you know, it's not surprising. The 15th Amendment was passed in the wake of the Civil War, just a few years after the Supreme Court said in Dred Scott that an African-American man had no rights that the white man was bound to respect. So you can see how the drafters of the 15th Amendment wanted the Supreme Court to defer to Congress on these issues. And you know, perhaps more practically, Congress is in a much better position to engage in the fact-finding that supports complicated legislative provisions like the coverage formula of the Voting Rights Act. And Congress did its job in 2006 when it was considering the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act by amassing a huge record that showed that the coverage formula continues to be accurate and responsive to the continued problem of racial discrimination in voting.
And they extended it for 25 years, and President George W. Bush signed it into law. And I believe, wasn't there a substantial majority in both the Senate and the House? In fact, almost a unanimous majority in the Congress?
Exactly. You know, we had 98 senators vote to reauthorize the coverage formula, reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, we have bipartisan majorities in Congress voting to reauthorize it with this coverage formula. And we had, as you mentioned, George W. Bush sign it into law. And now, unfortunately, we know that when Chief Justice Roberts says, oh, okay, Congress, go back to the drawing board on the coverage formula, we know that that's just going to result in gridlock in Congress, although I certainly hope that we again might see bipartisan majority come together to protect the right to vote. But, you know, we've seen what's been going on with Congress. And in the meantime, it means that the American people are left without this incredibly important protective measure that ensures that all Americans can enjoy the constitutional promise of free and fair access to the ballot box.
So if this decision had come down before the last election, and in the last election we know that in a lot of the states covered by the Voting Rights Act, and particularly Florida, for example, African Americans had to wait for hours and hours in line. There were just obviously deliberate obstacles thrown in their paths by Republican governors and Republican legislators in these states. It's just indisputable. So just a theoretical question. Had this law been struck down before that last election, is it possible that Romney could have won?
You know, I mean, it's certainly possible that minority voters could have been disenfranchised. You know, I don't know exactly how that breaks down in terms of the presidential vote, but, you know, I mean, you can draw that conclusion. And it's even with today's ruling, Texas has already said that they're going to implement their redistricting plan that a federal court using the Voting Rights Act preclearance provision said they were going to block because it negatively affected African American and Latino voters. So we already have seen that states that have been prevented from putting into effect these laws that could disenfranchise American voters on the basis of race could now go into effect.
Well, it just feels like these five conservative or right-wing justices in the Citizens United decision, they simply departed from precedent, from a system that was, you know, hardly working, but it wasn't completely broken, and they just absolutely eviscerated it and made a free-for-all with money. And there's no question, there is simply no question that subsequent to their decision on Citizens United, enormous amounts of money have poured into our political system, and most of it has come from anonymous donors supporting right-wing and Republican candidates. It's just a fact. All of that work that Karl Rove did, the anonymity that these 501c4 vehicles provided them with, was a huge advantage, not to say that Democrats didn't try to play catch-up. But you just start to see whether the five justices are acting out of pure partisanship. That's a question that you can certainly raise, but the results clearly show partisan advantage to conservative right-wing politics. There's just no escaping the fact that this ruling is going to help the Republicans and hurt the Democrats.
Well, I think the most important thing from my perspective is that it's likely to hurt American voters. And, you know, we all have the right, regardless of the color of our skin, to cast a vote, to be equal citizens, and have the full and meaningful political participation. And I am worried that this decision will negatively impact Americans' rights to the meaningful citizenship that the Constitution guarantees to us all, that unfortunately a majority of conservative justices on the Supreme Court today disregarded.
Well, but I'm just trying to get my head around this, Elizabeth Wydra, that the Chief Justice ruled basically saying, you know, the Voting Rights Act has worked, and now that it's worked, we're going to take away the reason why it worked. And our argument basically rests on the idea that this 40-year-old formula has worked, but we've decided it's unconstitutional, even though we won't afford you, the American people, the reasons why we've decided it's unconstitutional, and even cite the part of the Constitution that it's violated. You just get the feeling that these guys are just doing what they want to do, and the legal reasoning comes later, if it comes at all.
Yeah, and that's really important, because what the court has done today is they've second-guessed Congress, which the Constitution, that's not what the Constitution suggests is the court's job when it comes to protecting the right to vote. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, Chief Justice Roberts likes to say in his ruling that, you know, the South has changed. He pointed out that there are problems in other parts of the country that aren't covered by the formula. But, you know, the statute itself allows for, you know, hey, if the South has changed, if states in the South have changed, the statute allows for them to bail out of the coverage formula. If they don't have a recent history of discrimination in voting, they can bail out of that coverage formula and not be subject to it anymore. But it's very telling that Shelby County, Alabama, which brought this lawsuit in the first place, can't take advantage of that part of the statute, because they do have a recent history of voting discrimination. And so, you know, Chief Justice Roberts ignores that, but Congress put into the statute, you know, it's not 40 years out of date. If the South has changed sufficiently, as he kept saying, then those jurisdictions should be able to bail out. And if there are other parts of the country that have become so bad when it comes to racial discrimination in voting, the statute has a bail-in mechanism. So the statute, you know, Congress actually did a really good job with it and made it sufficiently flexible to be consistent with the times. And it is really just, frankly, heartbreaking that such an incredibly effective statutory provision of the Voting Rights Act has basically been dealt a fatal blow by a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, simply because it's been incredibly effective.
But just in closing, though, Elizabeth Wydra, they are completely ignoring the evidence that's so manifest that just in the last cycle, there were attempts at sort of reviving Jim Crow kinds of laws, voter IDs, which are expensive and then could fall under the idea of a poll tax, which it ruled against, I believe, in Georgia. Then you had the South Carolina case. And just look what's just happened in North Carolina. They're passing laws like crazy because the Republicans, an extremely conservative group of Republicans, control the entire state. And there's nothing to stop them except time and demographics, and they're moving with lightning speed. They're even passing laws, for example, that say that students cannot vote in their, you know, states and areas where they're attending college. They have to return home to vote. A clear attempt. In fact, they tried that in Texas to disenfranchise young people and particularly young minorities. It's just obvious what they're doing. They've been doing it, and now that the coast is clear for them, they're going to do a lot more of it.
Well, I think that's an important point, because as Justice Ginsburg noted in her dissent, what you're describing are sort of the sort of more subtle second generation barriers to voting that are used to suppress votes of minorities. And, you know, the court today wanted to say, oh, look, the particular tests and devices that were used in 1965 to suppress minority votes, those have been eradicated. So we don't need this particular coverage formula in the Voting Rights Act anymore. But as you note, it's very important to recognize that we have still today laws being passed that in the covered jurisdictions that are basically attempted substitutes for these first-generation barriers that originally triggered the preclearance provision in the first place.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Court of Appeals. She was also at the Supreme Court today when this tectonic ruling took place. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a voting rights and election protection specialist.
In a little tent, oh, and just like